Well, you want to get back to it? The book stuff?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's do it and let the English see us do it.
Hello again, friend. I know it's been a minute, but we are so happy to have you back for this episode of the Awesome Book Club. I'm Rhett, and if you're confused, lost, or simply need a refresher, this is the third installment of our conversation about Sapiens, a brief history of humankind. Sapiens, from Dr. Yuval Noah Harari, is a groundbreaking narrative of humanity's creation and evolution that explores the ways in which biology and history have defined us and enhanced our understanding of what it means to be human. That being said, we really, really encourage all of our new friends to join us from the start. You can do just that by pausing this thing right now and going to find episode 3, also called Sapiens Part 2. Don't worry, this will still be here when you get back. But hey, maybe you DGAF, right? You're a rebel. Maybe you're like me and you just hate watching the first act of movies. That's fine too. But hey, it's there if you want it, all right? If you're new and you don't want to go back, we record our podcast, our book club, in one large chunk, okay? And then we cut it up into more manageable bits and we throw them on iTunes all at once so you never miss a beat of our conversation. One last thing and we'll kick this thing off, okay? Chances are, if you're like us, you listen to a bunch of podcasts, all right? Imagine this. You got your earbuds in. And those dummies say something that you just can't abide. You throw your hands up in frustration and you shout at those yahoos, give them a piece of your mind. And all that graces your ears is the sad, hollow echo of your voice bouncing through the ether for all eternity. And those jackwagons move on like nothing was said. Well, enough is enough. We invite you to chime in on our Twitter, okay? You can find us at Awesome Book Club. But if 280 characters isn't enough, then send us an email at abc@airpodcast.com. And you can tell us what you love, what you hate. You can tell us your thoughts on a particular thing. We welcome it all. Enough with the games. We're going to press play on this bad boy. We hope you enjoy the episode. All right, welcome back to the Book Club podcast. When we last left off, we were just in the middle of Section 2, the Agricultural Revolution, which is a bit of a misnomer because agriculture gets covered early on and then it switches to myths and writing and injustice around different power dynamics that spring up around the agricultural system. And that's kind of where we were. We were talking about people building ideas and how powerful that is in like the Code of Hammurabi and the elites that kind of spring up. And then we didn't really get into the writing stuff. Did anyone, that wasn't a chapter that really stuck out to me, but did anyone feel big things or have any insights on humans developing writing and script and being able to communicate that way?
No. And I'll say, I was a little kind of like disappointed by like how quickly he kind of went over it because, you know, I often, for whatever reason, find myself embroiled in debates about the most important inventions of the human mind. And I often say that writing is the number one most important thing that we've ever developed because it sort of allows us to commit down, you know, let's say blueprints to make a machine to help other people or directions on how to harvest a certain plant or grow, you know, or find certain types of food or plan cities where people can be safe and all this sort of thing. Also laws, you know, complex trade agreements, you know, things like that. Our memories are fallible, you know, like we were talking about off air. But writing is a little less so. You can't argue with it after you put it down. I mean, you can, and we do all the time in courts. But to me, that's like single-handedly, like, I mean, obviously, I guess we're a little biased because history is only what we've committed to paper in the last 5 to 7,000 years. But, you know, look at the progress of humanity in those thousands of years, and it's never been faster. And it's because the propagation of ideas that, you know, help humanity can be shared very quickly. I mean, writing single-handedly, you know, projected Western civilization out of a dark age. You know, I guess that's kind of a weird thing to say because writing's been around for a while at that point. But, you know, the Roman Empire fell, Western civilization fell into a dark age, and then we collected and translated Islamic texts of science and all that sort of stuff, which sort of like propelled us towards the Renaissance, which then propelled us into the scientific revolution. So I don't know. I was a little bummed that it didn't go into it as in depth as I would have liked, but maybe it's just because I was reading super fast. I don't know. Taylor, what do you think?
Yeah, it did go by pretty quick. A couple things that I remember that were interesting. I believe he said that the Assyrians were kind of some of the forerunners in developing a writing system.
Sumerians or Assyrians?
Was it Sumerians? It might have been Sumerians. I can't remember.
Sumer was like the first, you know, like civilization, like the first empire or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't quite remember. But the interesting thing he said was that they were using base 6 number systems.
Which was mind-boggling to think like how far it carried over into our modern day.
Oh, well, I guess that's true because of like
circles.
Circles and things like that. True. So I thought that was interesting. He talked a little bit about like the difference between like a, what would you call it? Like a full-blown, well, maybe I'm getting it mixed up with
like
language.
A full script and a partial script.
Yeah, full script
script.
Yeah.
And it took a little while before, like at first when writing was, you know, invented, it was mostly used for things like accounting and stuff like that. So it took a little while for it to develop into something that represented language as a whole, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, it went by pretty quick for me as well. I know he did have an example about like, you know, two people were in a dispute, and before it used to been like you'd have to look for witnesses or whatever, but the fact that they had like accounting and writing done there, they could go back to like the archives or whatever.
In true human fashion, the first like, you know, written logs and records of things, of course, were tax records, which, when he was talking about that, I had a really good chuckle at that because, you know how humans are. Two things are certain in life, death and taxes.
Yeah, I'm just looking back right through the text right now. It is funny. He spends exactly 2 pages on numbers and kind of, or at least our modern numeric system going from 0 to 9 and then mathematical equations. Part of it is this book covers 100-some thousand years of history, of human history, or more. And so you're trying to cover a lot. So it makes sense. But this was kind of one of the, I guess I felt like this chapter didn't wow me as much as some of the previous ones. It just left me like jaw dropping, you know, but
yeah,
maybe it's not as exciting of a story. You know, we just, we need to collect taxes. So we invented writing and it got more complex over time and on to the next.
And maybe also I've just like inflated the importance of writing in my own life, you know, like maybe it's like I expected more because like that's my own like personal bias. I mean, you know, me and my wife argue about this all the time. Like she sort of thinks that like sanitation and like sewage system is like the most important thing, like moving water and moving waste and all that sort of stuff is the most important advancement in humanity. Whereas I think it's writing, but, you know, people can disagree all they want.
I think I, witnessed at least a conversation between you two guys about that.
Oh yeah. All the time. It comes up all the time.
It's good to know your own biases, though. If you're like, yeah, maybe I just wanted this to be the most important part of the book. Yeah. It wasn't.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just saying, I'm thinking about the next part also, because they, it basically, these chapters are very linked because it talks about how in order to organize human society beyond our biology, we created writing and we created order, like imagined order. Mm-hmm. And so these chapters, you know, work together a lot, but it's kind of sad to see that we just start the process of, we could, you know, with this new resource of food, everyone could be, have a good life, but instead you automatically get, you know, chieftains and rulers and people that become super powerful over other people. And the actual farmers' lives don't improve all that much.
Yeah.
I have something written here, and of course, some of my notes are extremely vague. So I was wondering if I just read my notes verbatim, if you guys could shed some light on them, and then if they're actually important, if you guys could maybe share your thoughts. One of the things that I wrote, and we talked about it a little bit in the last half, but you know, we talked about sort of the author's sort of cynical view on like romanticism. Did we touch on that at all?
I
don't know specifically. No.
Okay, well, my notes go on to say that he seems to be sort of cynical of the benefits of traveling abroad. Did you guys get that? I don't know, like, where that was in the book. Like, what a weird thing for me to, like, pick out. But I remember when I read this, it's like, oh, yeah, he was sort of like, I don't know, saying something. I don't know. You guys don't have any recollection of that?
I personally don't.
All right. We'll cut that out.
I remember that. I in reviewing the book for this podcast, I read back through that part, but I can't quite remember where it was.
Also,
maybe we'll come to it.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Okay. And let me read this other weird.
I think that was more to do with money.
Was it?
It was talking about how, you know, nowadays. How did that go? It was kind of like, young people now, instead of like, I can't remember. You know, some along the lines of like, they spend their money on going abroad and dealing with experiences or something rather than.
What's interesting about that is it makes me think of something that our good friend of the show, Yana, had said to me. She was just over here in the Pacific Northwest, all the way from the UK. She was talking to me about. People traveling. And one thing that she said that kind of stood out to me was, because I'm sort of this way where it's like, I like to travel. And I touched on this on the last half because I love to be sort of exposed to these like alien ideas and lifestyles and things like that, you know, alien to me anyway, completely normal to the people that have them. And I like to be, I like to be in a place where I'm the minority. I can't speak the language. You know, and I can muddle through and all that sort of thing. That just makes me feel good. And I come home and I feel good about like overcoming those sorts of challenges. But Yana had said that, you know, she had spent maybe like a month or so in Vietnam and that she met a lot of, you know, white people in Vietnam who were there spending money to essentially buy the third world experience, you know, which kind of made me chuckle because it's like, I guess in a way it's like I sort of did that like when I went down to Central America, but I'd like to think I'm a little bit better of a traveler than that, but maybe not. But I don't know. It kind of ties into like what I think maybe the author was talking about. I don't remember though. So, hey.
I think that kind of goes down the path of like lingering effects from colonialism. You know?
Yeah.
But the sad part is a lot of that, at this point in time, different places in the world rely on that. They rely on like the privileged, you know, white people from the UK or America or whatever coming to their country to spend money. Yeah. They rely on that, but it's also kind of been constructed by.
Well, like, it's opportunistic, right? Like their infrastructure and their economy is sort of geared towards that because people want to go and buy the third world experience and they're going to give it to them. You know, I don't know. It was definitely like that in Guatemala, right? Like you go to Japan, Japan's going to keep spinning no matter how many white people stop going there. Yeah. Guatemala, it's not the same, man. It's like people drive their personal vehicles as taxis. People offer their personal homes as places to stay or places of business where they can sell goods or they can make food. It's way different, you know, like a lot of people wouldn't be as good off if you know, I more quote unquote affluent people didn't go there.
This makes me think of just like reflecting on the book in general that, all right, in 12,000 BC before farming, you could take any hunter-gatherer foraging tribe around the world, and maybe they would have a relative difference based on, oh, they're in this fertile valley versus this more mountainous region. But no one has a yacht and is like, no one is pleasure cruising with slaves. How there's just not really those types of societies. So it is funny to think that in modern day we've advanced so far past that world. And then there are some people in the world, maybe in Guatemala, the poorest of the poor, who are way worse off than those hunter-gatherers were. They can't even provide for themselves in this system, which is that crazy.
Yeah,
that reminds me of something we didn't touch on. I can't quite remember. I think it was more towards the hunter-gatherer part of the book, but I'm not sure, which is the idea of a nuclear family. If I remember correctly, the way it was talked about was essentially back in the day, a long time ago, there wasn't really this norm about having a nuclear family with a husband and a wife and children, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, they even said that, they used to think that if a woman had sex with more men, it was more likely that she would get a better child.
Right.
Because she would get traits from each of the men. Like, so maybe somebody's like really strong, so he has that aspect. And the other guy, you know, is like a good orator or, you know, whatever. And so those kind of traits would all kind of be combined and given to the child, which is like so interesting.
And that brings me to the first note I wrote altogether and then I never talked about was, I want to know, when did human beings figure out? And this makes me think, because I'm reading the King Killer Chronicles again, Name of the Wind and Wise Man's Fear. Mm. When did human beings figure out that a child has one parent, or you know, one male parent rather? Excuse me. You know, when did they figure out that, like, you know, sex between one man, one woman, created a baby?
I mean, I guess there has to be like, there has to have been proof early on when there was a monogamous relationship happening and that person had a child, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I thought about that same thing. Like, was it during the scientific revolution or like,
well, it's funny
when did
because,
they confirm that?
Right. And it's funny to me because when I read Wise Man's Fear, you know, and apologies to any listener who hasn't read the book, but in it, you know, the main character goes to this land that's more matriarchal and they do not believe that a man has anything to do with conception of a child. And they have like recreational sex all the time. Which is kind of like hard for the main character to like understand, like how they don't grasp that. And they make fun of him for it. They're like, can you believe he actually thinks men have something to do with making babies? And he's like, yeah, it's science. That's the truth. And they're like, yeah, okay. And they like have names for him because they think his like little barbaric ideas are cute. And I used to laugh at that. I was like, that's kind of a weird thing. But then I finally realized while reading this book, I was like, wait, when did humanity actually figure that one out? And I guess there's no easy answer unless one of you guys have one.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't have an easy answer, but I think this does segue into, he talks a lot about gender and sex over the course of history.
Yeah.
How there are some exceptions that prove the rule, but just male domination has kind of been a thing for a long time in our species.
Yeah.
And this is something I brought up earlier because he talks about it being muscle power and then says, no, that doesn't really explain it because actually the people with the most muscles are normally grunts in society. He talks about aggression, but in fact, if women are cooperating more, they should probably be leaders. And then he talks about genetic differences and maybe, you know, patriarch genetically and like just, you know, ends up disagreeing with that and kind of throwing that out. So it kind of then leaves an open question of what the hell has been going on for the past 70,000 years.
Yeah.
And work, I think, at least in the modern society, well, God, Harvey Weinstein, all these fucking sexual abusers, we're not moving past it very quickly.
No.
But we're entering a new period. But did you all, when you read that, did you have any thoughts as to like, oh gosh, what's up with us? What are we doing?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me because, and this kind of ties in with what I was talking about at the very, very beginning of the podcast, how the first thing I read when I opened the book, it was like a picture of King Louis from France, and he's wearing tights with a skirt and these flamboyant colors and all of this stuff. And then there's a picture of Barack Obama, who, I don't give a shit who you are, that guy is one handsome mofo. And when he's wearing a tailored suit, like, yeah, that I look at him and I'm like, that's a man right there. I'm unashamed to say that. And it's interesting because our definition of like masculinity, at least how it's portrayed physically, has like changed like so dramatically. And even, you know, I was reading Teddy Roosevelt's biography, and we talked about this, I think, in our sort of like intro podcast, which, like I said before, may or may not air, where Teddy Roosevelt was saying that pink is a color for men because it stands out. And in fact, when he was a child, pink was the color of baby boys and blue was the color of baby girls. And I, you know, there's apparently like literature and all this stuff about like when that sort of flip-flopped. I don't know the exact circumstances of it, but it kind of came to be when people started marketing boy stuff and girl stuff, you know, and sort of splitting up that stuff, you know, especially with kids. But it is interesting, and it makes you wonder because even in animals, like look at lions, you know, male lions, they're these flamboyant creatures with this these giant, beautiful manes. And of course, they serve a function to protect them in fights against other male lions. But the females are the ones that do all the frickin' work and are the actual hunters and all this sort of stuff. And I don't know. It makes you wonder, like, why? And then we do have some societies that are a little bit more matriarchal than others. You know, when I was in Hawaii, and, you know, this could be totally wrong, but I was sort of led to believe by some of the locals that because we'd go out to restaurants and stuff like this. And, you know, my mom, bless her heart, she's not necessarily like the leader type in any sort of group. But anytime we'd go to a restaurant or anytime we'd go to some place, it was like locally owned and like not a chain. Like the waitresses or the hostesses or whoever would always look to my mom to see what the group wanted. And it's because Hawaiians have tended to be a little bit more like matriarchal, a little bit more like matriarch oriented than other cultures. I don't know. And maybe that's completely wrong, but that's sort of like what locals led to me to believe. I don't know. I'll close off my freaking 5-minute rant here by saying there is a quote in here that I thought was very interesting. He wrote, "Gender is a race in which some of the runners compete only for the bronze medal," which I think sort of sums up exactly where we are now. And I try to, you know, it's like I've gotten in debates with people about this who are clearly not sexist in any way, but the way that they approach equality is that they do not understand that some people are competing only for the bronze. They don't grasp that they don't have access to the gold medal. They're racing and they're racing with everyone, but they are only going to be competing for the bronze. So it's an interesting way to look at it. And I actually wholeheartedly agree with that quote.
Yeah. You look at the NBA versus the WNBA, like even if the national champions of the WNBA like win the national championship, like most people aren't going to care nearly as much as if it were the NBA, you know?
Yeah, look at the week that the American soccer team was blocked from the World Cup. That same week, the Rose City Thorns won the female national championship, and no one talked about it. I mean, people talked about it because we're from the Pacific Northwest, but like that, like nobody else talked about it. Like, that's a great accomplishment. And honestly, like the Thorns over here in Oregon, just as good of a freaking soccer team as the Timbers are. So I don't know what's up with that.
It's a... just to throw one more example in the pile, there was this great ESPN show called Stump the Schwab, where he would answer sports trivia from any sport and any history, and basically he was never wrong. And the first question in all these seasons that he got wrong was one on what are the four majors in the LPGA Tour. And it's like the four most important events, and he didn't know. And I think he got three, but still, yeah. There's two big questions in this chapter that I thought were really interesting, but one, he really solidly answers, which is why we have racial inequity in this country and in like all around the world. And he basically says, there's this great diagram that where a chance historical event leads to one race controlling the other, which leads to discriminatory laws, which leads to poverty and prejudice, and then it all feeds back into each other. So it's kind of this chance event that then creates these racial dynamics. We could easily be ruled by imperialist Africa that like went out and controlled all of the world. You know, and white people are it's like they're the worst, and black people are in power everywhere. That could have just happened, but it's a chance historical event that it worked out this way, and the kind of industrial revolution spring up where it did. But the gender thing isn't like that at all. It's just this is the way it's been. There's no like chance historical thing about it, and that the difference there is kind of. Those issues seem really united to me. You know, it seems like, oh, we need I'm a feminist, and also I'm fighting for racial justice. But actually, one of those things is just like an oddity of history, that we are where we are and we need to, you know, lift up oppressed minorities from white people. And the other one is, holy shit, this has been this way for so long. And it's a much more entrenched and complicated thing than just, oh, this event happened, and now we all like now our ancestors treated black people this way, and they were in power, and then, you know, I don't know. Do you guys, am I coming through with kind of the difference in those like two core?
Yeah, for sure.
I think so. Yeah, like, and he talks about like how if this were a simulation and we could relive history. Like, we could redo history 1,000 times and it would never end up the same.
Yeah.
But I think what you're saying is if we did run another simulation, it may not be that white people were like the top dogs or whatever, but it would probably still be that women were less equal than men.
Yeah, 100%. That's a great distillation of what I was saying. And I don't... What saddens me is that I don't know why, and he doesn't know why. And I mean, this is three men doing a podcast, so I guess
right. Three white straight men doing a podcast.
Maybe if we had some non-white non-men here.
Look, I'll encourage anybody who is not a straight white man to hop on your computer or open up your cell phone, record your rebuttal or your answer to our mystery here, and we'll play it on the podcast. If you know, if it holds water, if it's just you being a dumbass, then we might not. But you know, if you actually attempt to answer our question and it sort of hits at the heart of what we're saying, we'll play it, because you know, we want more voices than just ours. Which is you know, kind of why we picked a you know, a non-cis American man book to read. Or at least I hope that's why we picked it, so.
Yeah. And on that topic, I'm like worried a little bit that our next book is not going to be anywhere near as deep as this one. But I don't know.
That's okay, dude. Later. Don't worry about
it. You want to give a brief preview of it? Just like a quick teaser?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about it, but the book is called Hiroshima by John Hersey, and it's essentially just six stories of survivors from when the U.S. bombed Hiroshima back in 1945. And the reason I picked it was because Rhett and I just got back from Japan, and we went to Hiroshima, and it was just really powerful. And I want to know more about the history of Japan, and especially because, like, holy cow, like, what the U.S. did to Japan is just insane, you know, that even happened in history. So,
well, that's the amazing part about war is that both sides, like, there's no good or evil side. There is just two sides of a conflict with their own self-interests and what both sides did to each other and to other people in the world is just horrific. But like dropping the bomb, like that is a act unparalleled in the course of human history.
Yeah.
And not to interrupt you too much, but it's like, well, when we were at the museum.
Yeah, I'm excited to read it though. And I'm looking forward to it. And just so listeners know, we're kind of planning these in trios where we all pick a book and then we rotate through and then we start with a new trio. Do you want to talk about your book, Rhett, just so we can give people like a couple books out?
I don't know.
Has Rhett decided?
I haven't, I know I talked about The Diary of Anne Frank a lot. And I don't know if that's what you guys thought I picked, but I thought that I had picked that. And then I thought that I might pick something else. I've never read The Diary of Anne Frank. But Kurt had brought up a good point that it's like he wanted his picks to sort of be from like non-white men. And, and I, you know, it's just like with everything going on in American politics and current events, there's been a lot of sort of just like, you know, sort of resurgence of like fascist tendencies and all these sorts of things. And I thought it might serve as a good reminder to read the book of a person who lived through fascism and died because of fascism. And not only that, but the idea of The Diary of Anne Frank interests me specifically because of the unabridged version when they were just like, oh yeah, she's like a legit motherfucking human being who, you know, talks about her life much like a adolescent girl would be nowadays. And for some reason, it's like, you know, we all know of Anne Frank, but to me, it's like I've never really, and I don't mean to sound heartless, but I've never really like regarded her as like a human being. Like, right, she's like a historical figure, and that's it. But then here, just like some of the stuff, you know, I've read a few passages and things like that. I'm just like, oh shit! And like, she was a little freaking girl, and humanity like let some like really barbaric things happen to her. So I don't know. That was kind of the pick that I was leaning towards. I don't know what anybody else thought I might have picked. I might change, but that's kind of where I'm leaning. So we'll see.
Yeah, I'd be interested. I've never read her diary either, but
what did you guys think I picked? Is that what you guys thought I picked?
You threw out like several titles, so I didn't know what it was. I don't even remember you saying The Diary of Anne Frank, to be honest.
Yeah, I just tossed it out there because I wasn't sure. So I read. And your book.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's the one I've been leaning towards the most. However, I'll admit to this being a completely unoriginal idea, and I don't want to downplay, Anne Frank at all. But the other book that I've sort of been very interested in reading lately is called Salt by Mark Kurlansky, and it's a history of salt. I don't know. It seems very interesting. He wrote another one called Cod, and it's all about how cod changed the world, which also seems very interesting. I don't know. Look, we're going to read Hiroshima, and then we're going to get to my book, and I want your guys' input because I don't want anybody to be like turned off by whatever I pick. But I'm just like overwhelmed with options, you know?
Yeah.
So funny.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. That's I'm looking forward to it. Well, we don't have to know right now, but it's good to, I think it's helpful for people to talk, hear us talk through these picks too, so they kind of know what we're thinking about.
Yeah. And, I think as we kind of like get closer, maybe next time we record, I'll have sort of like nailed down my, my choice for sure, so that people can procure their own copies if they'd care to, you know, join the dialogue and that sort of thing.
Totally.
Sweet. That sounds good. Well, yeah, just getting back to the book, I feel like it's time we move on to part three.
Boom, 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 boom.
The unification
of
humankind. And I think the overall point in this part, of course, unification. So talks about religion, talks about empire and imperial visions, and money, and how we're all these things are bringing us together as one, as some sort of like singular culture. And that's the direction history is moving in, is simplifying and unifying.
Yeah. I have a couple of interesting notes here, and I've been dominating the mic. So if anybody wants to go first, now's your chance.
Feel free, dude. I'm looking at mine.
Okay. So a couple things. The thing that fascinated me most, obviously, is the idea that like money is like the biggest unifier in humanity. And he talks about tribes that use seashells as money, or, you know, precious stones as money. You know, for a while, Americans used a banknote that was backed by gold inside a vault. Now we use paper that has imaginary value, as most money actually carries imaginary value. It has no real backing at all other than what value we assign to it on our minds. But what it really interested me was the fact that a friend of the show, John Blatchford, and also the fourth in our, I think we talked about this in the episode that may or may not air, but Kurt and Taylor and I were once in a sweet rock and roll band, and John was the fourth member of that band. And when he graduated high school, he went to the small island nation in the South Pacific called Yap. And there in Yap, they still use millstones as currency. But not necessarily currency, you know, the way that we view it. You know, they don't use it for everyday stuff. Nowadays, it's sort of more about buying land and also dowries in weddings and things like that. And Yap is a very, very, very small island. But some of the older families still have these huge, immovable millstones that rest, you know, on their land and things like that. Which anybody that doesn't know what I'm talking about, just Google YAP, which is YAP, millstone. And you'll see instantly what we're talking about. I mean, they're a pretty iconic image. Maybe I totally just made this up. I'm going to see about...
No, just, aren't they like massive stones?
Yeah, they're huge millstones. I mean, look, if you got your computer in front of you, Google YAP millstone right now.
It. It's and like as tall as a person.
Yeah, they're freaking huge. They're immovable. Most of the big ones are immovable. Yet they do have millstones that are small enough to fit into your hand because they've been worn down or they have some symbolic, you know, symbolic value. But yeah, most houses, like if you Google it, there's a couple pictures on Google Images where there is a traditional house with these millstones surrounding, and some of them are as tall as a human being. Others are about, you know, they go up to your knee or your waist, somewhere around there, but they all have the hole in the middle and they're all circular. Usually they're standing. That's a big part of it. It's very interesting. John brought a lot of pictures back home when he came home from Yap about that. And you've even can see it in some TV shows and all that sort of stuff. But going on from there, a quote from page 186, he says, "Money is the only trust system created by human beings that can bridge almost any cultural gap," which is true. When you think about how many times have you posted something on Craigslist or something on eBay, you don't know this person you're selling something to, and they don't know you. They don't know if the thing they're buying is going to work or what, but you sort of just both worship the same God, George Washington, the dollar bill, or Benjamin Franklin, the $100 bill, I guess. And you don't need to know who that person is as long as they have money, right? It's kind of a weird thing.
Well, I thought his like he talks about the barter system and how that worked for a really long time and it was a good thing for economy and everything, but he then talks about how, you know, what happens if the apple farmer, you know, needs a haircut or whatever,
right,
but the barber doesn't like apples. Like, well, now he has to figure out a way to like get this guy something that he needs that's not apples, you know?
Yeah.
It's a way to like build in trust into the system so that they can do whatever they want with the money, you know?
Yeah. It's really fascinating in a sense because, you know, I've talked with this with my brother who was in law school for a long time about the barter system. You know, one of the first interactions between my family and my wife's family, not interactions. Well, yeah, it was one of the first interactions, like, you know, after I was in a relationship with Bailey. Bailey's dad is an electrician, and my dad for years and years and years is a contractor, you know, and for a while when I was in high school, we painted houses and did repairs on houses and this sort of stuff. And one time, you know, my dad was working on this part of his house. It was like an outbuilding on our property that like never had lights or electricity or any of this stuff. And Bailey's dad was like, well, you know, I could do that. And then I mentioned that to my dad. And then eventually Bailey's dad had mentioned like, well, I need work done on this house. You know, and then I mentioned that to my dad and he's like, well, I could do that. If he wants to do the lighting and the electricity and this thing, I'll go and do work on this thing. And they swapped their trades and they did this really cool thing for each other. And from there on, I've sort of been like infatuated with the barter system in a weird way, because it's like, we all have skills that are monetizable or valuable to other people. Yet, you know, we're taught that the only way to make money or the only way to acquire material goods is to go to work your 9 to 5 and punch the clock, go home at night and collect your paycheck at the end of the week. But, you know, there's so many other ways, you know, it's like Taylor, you know, is in IT. It's like, well, what if I'm starting a small business or have a space that's like, I don't understand anything about networking or something like that. He can come take care of that for me. And well, okay, well, maybe he could use some services that I have, you know, and I have access to certain services that other people don't. I can give those to him. And Jason, my brother in law school, he was just like totally opposed to this idea because he understood that for whatever reason, the government has caught onto this and requires us to attach a monetary value to like bartered services and goods because we need to pay taxes on those things, which infuriates me. Thoughts?
It kind of reminds me a little bit of just how like we used to play poker a lot, and I guess technically that's illegal because
yeah, it is,
you know, we're supposed to pay taxes on the winnings, right? But I don't know. It's kind of like anything else these days where, I mean, I see that kind of thing happen all the time. Like I remember, at the golf course, people would, you know, do some sort of thing to help the golf course and then they'd be given free golf for a while, you know. It all just depends, and I guess it might depend on the location, how involved the government is where you are. Like where we're from, it's pretty like out in the boons, you know, the boondocks or whatever.
Yeah, a whole 20 miles from I-5.
So I'm sure there's like tons of work that's done under the table, and yeah, we probably rely more on the barter system than other places, you know.
Yeah.
So I like, my feeling on this is I like that each of us, and maybe Taylor, you need it, yours will be coming, but each of us has parts of Sapiens where that we yearn for, that we're like reminisce and want to go back towards. Mine is very strongly hunter-gatherer days. I just want to be a hunter-gatherer. I think that'd be so fun.
Yeah.
And life would be great, and you'd always be on the road, and you'd have your band, and you'd, you know, do things together. And Rhett, and this,
Rhett's is the bartering.
Rhett's is the barter system, which is great. Like, and that's,
you know what though, that ties into the hunter gatherer. Okay, I want to get some pelts. I want to find some sweet sharp rocks, and I want to trade them to some friendly bands that you know, we meet once a year on the crossroads of the mountains. You know what I'm saying?
It does make sense, but I like. It is kind of one of those, it's part of that theme of we can't go back. And
yeah,
so it,
yeah.
I think when it happens on an informal level every now and then, that's super cool. And that, why would that ever be a bad thing? But just the money system is so powerful. And I don't know how to escape it. I don't think anyone does.
Yeah.
And we'll see. Unless you're really living off the grid somewhere. And even then, right, to buy the stuff to live off the grid, you'll need money.
See, and that's the thing. That's the thing that that really interests me is like this idea of like escaping the grind, right? It's sort of like escaping the humdrum of like going to the 9 to 5 and collecting your paycheck at the end of the week that I was just talking about. And I think the number one way to do that is to get off the grid. The number one way to do that is figure out how to generate your own electricity. And obviously, like, you know, Tesla is well on their way to being able to provide this for people with their recent investments in solar power and their recent breakthroughs in lithium ion batteries. There's so much potential here. And I talk about this with a friend of the show, Lee Para, all the time, you know, and now we're taking a blacksmith course and we run a foundry and a forge. We can cast our own metal and work our own metal and this sort of stuff. And it's like, we should make our own solar power system and we should get off the grid. And you know, you quit paying money for electricity and that frees you up to do so much extra stuff. And then at a certain point, you know, that's sort of how you escape this sort of, I don't think the monetary system will ever truly go away. And Harari, talks about it, quite a bit. It's like, well, in the absence of money, people use other things as money. In prison, they use cigarettes, right? Which is like, oh yeah. And we talk about it all the time when people are talking about shit hitting the fan and they got their bug out bags and they got their doomsday prep, bunkers in the back. It's like, what do they have? They've got silver, they've got bullets, and they have distilled spirits. That's the currency of like the post-apocalypse for whatever reason. These like role play, you know, and that's all these. I honestly feel like doomsday preppers are just like adult role players, right? Like they feel ashamed of playing Dungeons and Dragons, but they can build a bunker in their backyard and nobody's going to bat an eyelash at them.
Well, see, Kurt, when Kurt was saying that there's no way for us to go back, I was thinking the whole time, there's no way for us to go back unless we're forced to go back.
Yeah. And, for sure.
And I think once, like, if the financial markets crash so badly that people begin abandoning them, then we're probably going back to the bartering system.
I've always sort of held the belief that, that's the only way that the class divide will end, is when the lower class looks at the rich elites and they say, hey, screw you, we don't need you anymore.
Yeah.
And that's sort of almost like a post-apocalypse that some people envision where, you know, we just like literally break off and we assign our own imaginary values to things and, you know, move forward from there.
I want to...
We're way off course. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, guys.
Alrighty, I'm going to pull off here for a short rest. Make sure you use the bathroom, get some water, maybe a snack. Hey, and when you're ready, you can find the next episode the same place you found this one, be it iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever your preferred podcast platform may be. But before you go, we really appreciate it if you could take the time to hop on iTunes or whatever you use and leave us a rating and a review. It's your chance to tell the world what you thought. Love it or hate it, they really go a long ways to helping us stay visible and helps like-minded people discover us. Your review may be the one that convinces people to give us a shot. Or not. Either way, thank you so much. And if you're the sort that doesn't like to miss a beat, hit subscribe and never miss an episode. Thanks a lot, folks. We'll see you in a minute.